WHFR and Metaphysically Speaking are teaming up once again in order to bring you our 5th annual Festival of Enlightenment Holistic Fair on Saturday, March 23rd from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. in the Henry Ford Community College Student and Culinary Arts Center. As usual, we are thrilled and excited to bring you this premier holistic event. This year's festival promises to be bigger and better than ever. If you would like to join us as a vendor, reader, or body healer, please call 313-317-6540 or email us at holistic2010@peoplepc.com. Once again, that's call us at 313-317-6540 or email us at holistic2010@peoplepc.com. We hope you are able to join us at this fantastic festival.
Hey, this is Brian Vander Ark, and you're listening to my music on WHFR Dearborn.
This is how war starts. One day, you're living your ordinary life. You're planning to go to a party. You're taking your children to school. You're making a dentist appointment. The next thing, the telephones go out. The TVs go out. There's armed men on the street. There's roadblocks. Your life, as you know it, goes into suspended animation. It stops. I'm going to steal a story from a friend of mine, a Bosnian friend, about what happened to her, because I think it will illustrate for you exactly what it feels like. She was walking to work one day in April 1992 in a miniskirt and high heels. She worked in a bank. She was a young mother. She was someone who liked to party. Great person. And suddenly she sees a tank ambling down the main road of Sarajevo, knocking everything out of its path. She thinks she's dreaming. But she's not. And she runs as any of us would have done and takes cover, and she hides behind a trash bin in her high heels and her miniskirt. And as she's hiding there, she's feeling ridiculous, but she's seeing this tank go by with soldiers and people all over the place in chaos, and she thinks, I feel like Alice in Wonderland going down the rabbit hole, down, down, down into chaos. And my life will never be the same again. A few weeks later, my friend was in a crowd of people pushing with her infant son in her arms to give him to a stranger on a bus, which was one of the last buses leaving Sarajevo, to take children out so they could be safe. And she remembers struggling with her mother to the front, crowds and crowds of people, take my child, and passing her son to someone through a window. And she didn't see him for years. The siege went on for 3.5 years. And it was a siege without water, without power, without electricity, without heat, without food, in the middle of Europe, in the middle of the 20th century. I had the honor of being one of those reporters that lived through that siege. And I say I have the honor and the privilege of being there because it's taught me everything, not just about being a reporter, but about being a human being. I learned about compassion. I learned about ordinary people who could be heroes. I learned about sharing. I learned about camaraderie. Most of all, I learned about love. Even in the midst of terrible destruction and death and chaos, I learned how ordinary people could help their neighbors, share food, raise their children, drag someone who's being sniped at from the middle of the road, even though you yourself were endangering your life, helping people get into taxis who were injured to try to take them to hospitals. I learned so much about myself. Martha Gellhorn, who's one of my heroes, once said, you can only love one war, the rest is responsibility. I went on to cover many, many, many wars after that. so many that I lost count, but there was nothing like Sarajevo. Last April, I went back to a very strange, what I called a deranged high school reunion. What it was the 20th anniversary of the siege, the beginning of the siege of Sarajevo. And I don't like the word anniversary because it sounds like a party, and this was not a party. It was a very somber gathering of the reporters that worked there during the war, humanitarian aid workers, and of course the brave and courageous people of Sarajevo themselves. And the thing that struck me the most, that broke my heart, was walking down the main street of Sarajevo where my friend Aida saw the tank coming 20 years ago. And in that road were 12,000, more than 12,000 red chairs, empty. And every single one of them symbolized a person who had died during the siege, just in Sarajevo, not in all of Bosnia. And it stretched from one end of the city to a large part of it. And the saddest for me were the tiny little chairs for the children. I now cover Syria, and I started reporting it because I believe that it needs to be done. I believe a story there has to be told. I see again a template of the war in Bosnia. And when I first arrived in Damascus, I saw this strange moment where people didn't seem to believe that war was going to descend. And it was exactly the same in Bosnia and nearly every other country I've seen where war comes. People don't want to believe it's coming. So they don't leave. They don't leave before they can. They don't get their money out. They stay because you want to stay in your home. And then war and chaos descends. Rwanda is a place that haunts me a lot. In 1994, I briefly left Sarajevo to go report the genocide in Rwanda. Between April and August 1994, 1 million people were slaughtered. Now, if those 12,000 chairs freaked me out with the sheer number, I want you just for a second to think of 1 million people. And to give you some example, I remember standing and looking down a road as far as I could see, at least a mile, and there were bodies piled twice my height of the dead. And that was just a small percentage of the dead. And there were mothers holding their children who had been caught in the last death throes. So we learn a lot from war. And I mention Rwanda because it is one place, like South Africa, where nearly 20 years on, there is healing. 56% of the parliamentarians are women, which is fantastic. And there's also within the national constitution now, you're actually not allowed to say Hutu or Tutsi. You're not allowed to identify anyone by ethnicity, which is, of course, what started the slaughter in the first place. And an aid worker friend of mine told me the most beautiful story, or I find it beautiful. There was a group of children, mixed Hutus and Tutsis, and a group of women who were adopting them. And they lined up, and one was just given to the next. There was no kind of compensation for, you're a Tutsi, you're a Hutu. You might have killed my mother, you might have killed my father. They were just brought together in this kind of reconciliation. And I find this remarkable. So when people ask me how I continue to cover war and why I continue to do it, this is why. When I go back to Syria next week, in fact, what I see is incredibly heroic people, some of them fighting for democracy, for things we take for granted every single day. And that's pretty much why I do it. In 2004, I had a little baby boy, and I call him my miracle child because after seeing so much death and destruction and chaos and darkness in my life, this ray of hope was born. And I called him Luca, which means the bringer of light, because he does bring life, light to my life. But I'm talking about him because when he was 4 months old, my foreign editor forced me to go back to Baghdad, where I had been reporting all throughout the Saddam regime and during the fall of Baghdad and afterwards. And I remember getting on the plane in tears, crying to be separated from my son. And while I was there, a quite famous Iraqi politician who was a friend of mine said to me, "What are you doing here? Why aren't you home with Luca?" And I said, "Well, I have to see." It was 2004, which was the beginning of the incredibly bloody time in Iraq. I have to see what is happening here. I have to report it. And he said, "Go home. Because if you miss his first tooth, if you miss his first step, you'll never forgive yourself. But there will always be another war. And there, sadly, will always be wars. And I am deluding myself if I think, as a journalist, as a reporter, as a writer, what I do can stop them. I can't. I'm not Kofi Annan. He can't stop a war. He tried to negotiate Syria and couldn't do it. I'm not a UN conflict resolution person. I'm not even a humanitarian aid doctor, and I can't tell you the times of how helpless I felt to have people dying in front of me, and I couldn't save them. All I am is a witness. My role is to bring a voice to people who are voiceless. A colleague of mine described it as to shine a light in the darkest corners of the world, and that's what I try to do. I'm not always successful, and sometimes it's incredibly frustrating because you feel like you're writing into a void, or you feel like no one cares. Who cares about Syria? Who cares about Bosnia? Who cares about the Congo, the Ivory Coast, Liberia, Sierra Leone, all of these strings of places that I will remember for the rest of my life? But my métier is to bear witness, and that is the crux, the heart of the matter for us reporters who do this. And all I can really do is hope, not to policymakers or politicians, because as much as I'd like to have faith that they read my words and do something, I don't delude myself. But what I do hope is that if you remember anything I said or any of my stories tomorrow morning over breakfast, if you can remember the story of Sarajevo or the story of Rwanda, then I've done my job. Thank you very much.
Hello, I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for downloading this episode of Philosophy Talk. Your support helps keep Philosophy Talk on the air and online.
We appreciate your support.
And as always, thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence.
I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm not. I'm John Perry.
We're coming to you from the Marsh Theater, the Bay Area's breeding ground for new performance.
Our thinking originates down the road at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus. That's where Ken is a professor of philosophy and I am an old fart.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Today, the linguistics of name-calling.
Well, Ken, name-calling is widely regarded as a bad thing, but from a linguistic perspective, it's just another interesting thing. In fact, a really fascinating phenomenon.
Well, John, name-calling is regarded as a bad thing because it is a bad thing. Look, decent people shouldn't use words like the infamous N-word or the K-word as applied to Jewish people. They just shouldn't do that.
Well, I agree, Ken, but let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. Take the word a-hole. Now, for those of you who are really clueless, we have in mind a compound word, the first part of which is a name for donkeys, and the last part of which is hole. It's a marvelous little word, even though we can't say it on the radio, and it's a true linguistic wonder.
Well, it may be wonder, but it sounds like you find the a-word less offensive than the N-word, is that right?
Oh, I certainly do. The N-word is a terrible and ugly word.
To call somebody the N-word is to imply that they are inferior because of their race. They're worthy of contempt because of their race. It is to say something false and uncalled for. On the other hand, admit it, some people really are a-holes. They deserve to be called what they really are.
Well, John, the A-word may not be as harsh as the N-word. I grant you that. I grant you that. But it still shouldn't be used in polite speech. I mean, suppose that Barack Obama found himself thinking during one of those debates, oh, God, what an a-hole that Romney is. I mean, even if that's true, Obama would have never dared utter that word in that context. He just wouldn't have. Even if Romney was really and truly being, you know, an a-hole.
I can't believe Obama would have such a thought, Ken. The A-word the A-word may be impolite, but it's often a perfectly apt word. That makes it different from the N-word, which is never apt in any context.
Let's distinguish three different things. Three different ways that words of, let's call it, I don't know, soft derogation, like the A-word, can differ from more harshly derogatory words like the N-word. First, a statement like Jones is a real a-hole, that can be flat-out true or flat-out false, right?
Well, that's certainly one thing that distinguishes the A-word from the N-word. You can't ever apply the N-word truly to anyone because no one is contemptible just because of their race. So, first point, you're right. When you call someone the N-word, you're saying something false.
Right. And then there's a second thing, is that the very act of calling someone the N-word, it's not just factually incorrect. It's also deeply morally problematic.
Why? Being called the A-word certainly stings, but the sting of being called the A-word may be well-deserved, and the sting of being called the N-word is never deserved.
But then there's also this fact that it's often just plain impolite to call someone the A-word, even if, in fact, they're being an a-hole. It's just something you shouldn't say in polite company.
Well, I don't think you've got it quite right, and this goes back to my earlier point. The A-word is definitely not a polite word. But that's what gives it such power. Suppose, counterfactually, this would never happen, you're mistreating a student or an employee. Your lovely wife, Claire, pulls you aside and says, in a firm but loving tone, Ken, quit being such an a-hole. You shouldn't be offended. You should be grateful to her.
Yeah, maybe. I get your point. But, you know, it's one thing to lovingly admonish someone you care about in the privacy of your own bedroom or whatever with that word. It's really a completely different thing to hurl that word at somebody, like in the heat of an argument. That's going to make things worse. It's never going to make it better.
It just shows how flexible, powerful, and useful the A word can be. It's a word that, for good or ill, gets people's attention. It's really a marvelous thing that English language has given us, a wonderful tool.
Oh, it may be marvelous, but, you know, John, it's also dangerous. I mean, take Rush Limbaugh, for example. He habitually calls feminists feminazis, and some Democrats I know habitually call Republicans repugnants. Now, the use of such words, the overuse of such words especially, is coarsening our public discourse. The more we think and talk about each other in such terms, the less we're prone to listen to each other respectfully. I think it's a really bad thing.
Well, Ken, as is often the case on this show, you're feeling nostalgic for a world that you never knew. The barrier between impolite speech and public discourse came tumbling down long ago, before either of us were born. There's no way to put it back again.
Gosh, that's a depressing thought. I really hope you're wrong. Nostalgia or not, I just hope you're wrong. But, you know, obviously there's a lot to think and talk about here, both linguistically and socially.
Now, to help us set the stage for the exploration of the linguistics or name-calling, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch, to an odd place, out to a playground, and she watched as kids transform ordinary names for fruit into stinging epithets. She files this report.
This is a story about the power of mangoes and bananas.
We made names so we could talk amongst ourselves and go like, oh, kiwi's such a mango, or apple's such a banana.
When Elizabeth Pine was a fifth grader at a small public school outside Seattle, she and a few friends made up a secret code. The names of fruits and vegetables stood in for the names of classmates and common phrases. She says they did it to get back at some popular girls who were bullying them.
They had created a language that, to our understanding, only had like about one word in it. It was ice cream. but they'd like point and laugh at us, and then they'd go like ice cream and start laughing again, and we got kind of fed up with it, so we said, hey, we'll make our own language, you know, two can play at this game.
So Elizabeth and her friends made up a fruit and vegetable language. First, they chose names for themselves.
My name was Broccoli, and my friends, let's see, I think there was string bean, asparagus, carrot, and lima bean or something.
Then they came up with names for the bullies, Apple and Kiwi, and words for yes, no, hello, and goodbye. The word banana meant bad word, and mango meant very bad word.
We made ice cream mean I'm a leprechaun, so just to kind of get back at them.
Elizabeth's mother, Judy Pine, is a linguistic anthropologist at Western Washington University. She thought the language was a creative way to deal with playground bullies.
That was my thought about it, was that isn't this a marvelous way to deal with the inevitable conflict between people in the playground?
Well, word of Elizabeth's secret language got out, and like a bad game of telephone, banana came to mean one particular bad word, and mango came to mean another.
These two boys were out on the playground during lunch recess, and they were harassing one of the more fragile girls in our class and yelling mango and banana because they'd heard about our language. And then when she went to the office to get help, we got in trouble for making the language that they were calling her names in.
Elizabeth's mother, Judy, remembers getting an angry call from the principal.
She was just beside herself about this.
So Judy went to the principal's office to talk it over.
I kept asking, so did Elizabeth use these words to bully? And she said, no, Elizabeth didn't, but Elizabeth wrote them down. And I was really struck by the fact that this principal saw these words, mango and banana, so powerful that a fifth grader writing them down had committed a really serious offense.
Elizabeth is a bright girl. She gets good grades and likes to read. But lately, she'd been the target of schoolyard bullies. She stopped playing kickball with the rest of the class at recess. Instead, she would read.
And people would tease me for that, and people would, like, I don't know if they called me specific names behind my back or anything, but they'd tease me and throw the kickball at me. Like, I don't know, it would hit me sometimes.
I remember you coming home in tears over having been called a geek. Mm. And Daddy and I spending some time trying to say, well, you know, we're geeks too, and geek is good.
Yeah. But I still don't want to be called a geek. I don't really want to be this thing if people are going to outcast me like this.
Judy says the principal didn't seem to care much about fifth graders flinging around the word geek. And that's what bothered her more than anything.
The principal found mango and banana frightening for reasons that I understand based on where she's coming from. And I find the demonization of intelligence in our national conversation really quite disturbing.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
I'm John Perry, along with my fellow Stanford philosopher Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Marsh Theater in Berkeley.
Our guest today is a professor of linguistics from the UC Berkeley School of Information. He's also a regular contributor to NPR and the New York Times, and he's a prolific author, most recently of A Sense of the A-Word, A-holism, the First 60 Years. So please join us now in welcoming Jeff Nunberg.
Jeff, as a linguist, you're kind of professionally obliged to be interested in all sorts of language. But professional obligations aside, you seem to find derogatory language really fascinating, and the A word in particular. You've written a whole book about it. What drove you to this?
Well, I mean, in the first place, you wouldn't write a book about something like the A word without wanting to engage in a certain amount of self-reflection. You know, as the poet said, fool, look in your heart and write. So there was some of that. But I became interested in the word when I was actually writing about political discourse, a book I published in 2006 called Talking Right. And I was listening to a lot of, in particular, right-wing radio and cable news and so on. And it struck me not the what you might think is the obvious thing, that these people were behaving like a-holes, but that there was a kind of underlying moral logic involved where if you depicted the other side as a-holes, as pretentious, self-important, snooty, out-of-touch East Coast or West Coast liberals, you got to be an a-hole back at them. And that was the kind of dynamic that was driving the conversation there. And I became interested in this idea of the a-hole itself. Then I got interested in the word, and I started to look at its history, and I realized this is an extraordinary history of this word. It's coined in World War II. It becomes part of the language, really, in the late 60s and 70s. And to tell its story, you really have to recapitulate about two-thirds of the social history of the last 50 years. And that's really what drove the project at that point.
Well, I can understand that, how you got a whole book out of that. Now, earlier, Ken and I were playing with the idea that to call someone an a-hole can be morally okay and even factually true, I mean, given the metaphorical use, I guess, even though it is somewhat impolite. Now, is that basically, you agree with that?
Yeah, I think it's true. I spoke of the moral logic of a-holism, and that's the idea that if somebody is behaving like a jerk, you get to be a jerk back at them, that you get to swear at them, mm-hmm. which is what you're doing when you pronounce the a-hole. Now, in certain contexts, like public discourse, that's very problematic. But in everyday life, there are times when you're not simply permitted to use the a-word, but you're almost obliged to. Your sister calls you, and she says she's just discovered her husband is having an affair with a babysitter. There's only one thing you can say. What an a-hole, by way of demonstrating your own indignation and inviting her to replace her hurt with the anger that word suggests. So it's an extremely useful social move, and there's a very good reason why we have it in the language and why there are times when we have to use it.
Apart from its literal meaning, does it have any real meaning, a-hole?
Oh, yeah, sure. It's a very specific word. You can be an a-hole for cheating on your wife, but not, say, for cheating on your income tax. You can be an a-hole for cutting off somebody on the highway, but not maybe for texting while you drive. You can be an a-hole for stealing ideas from a colleague, but maybe not from plagiarizing from a published book, unless it's by one of us.
This is Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Mars Theater in Berkeley. We're talking about the linguistics of name-calling with Jeff Nunberg, author of The Ascent of the A-Word.
Now, in our next segment, we're going to ask how derogatory words, both of the kind of milder variety and the harsher variety, where do they get their power to sting? Do words sting because of what they mean? Or is it because they're taboo and impolite that they come to have the meaning they do? And why is it that some words but not others are really regarded as taboo or impolite in the first place?
Why words sting, along with questions from our audience, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Thanks to our musical guest, the Playtones. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Berkeley professor Jeff Nunberg, and we're talking about the linguistics of name-calling.
How do mere words sometimes manage to sting so much? Do words sting because of what they mean? When is it okay to use words that sting, and when is it not okay? What do you think? Join the discussion by stepping up to the microphone in front of the stage.
So, Jeff, I want to go back to where you and John were toward the end of the last segment. I want to talk about where this power of derogatory words to hurt comes from. And here's my hunch. It's got something to do with their intrinsic linguistic character. It's like certain words are linguistically designed by the very nature of their meaning to be hurtful. What do you think about that hunch?
Well, you know, after the fact, you look at the list of racial and ethnic and religious slurs in English, and you're struck by certain things. They almost invariably, not invariably, but almost invariably have a K or a G in them. Now, I'll leave you to do that experiment yourself. Radio is not the place to talk about that. No. But there's lots of words that have K's and G's in them that are perfectly benign.
Right.
I think they acquire this character and we're talking about racial and ethnic words now, because they're associated with people who have those feelings. It's not an obvious remark that there's two ways to think about these words. Either you could say that racists use the N-word because it's derogatory, or you could say that the N-word is derogatory
because
racists use it. And I really think it's a second case. I think when you use the N-word, you're impersonating or affiliating with the kind of people who have that name for those people.
So you don't think. I mean, you might think there's a kind of linguistic marker that goes with a word that marks it as derogatory. Right? I mean, when you look in dictionaries, they say, a-hole, word of contempt for overbearing, blah, blah, blah. So it's like they think the contempt function, the expressing contempt function, is kind of linguistically marked. You don't sound like you agree with that.
I don't think it has anything to do with the shape of the word.
Well, not the shape of the word, but the semantics of it.
But, yes, I think in the case of a-hole, that's a very different kind of word from these derogatory. I think that's a word that that contains both description and evaluation. It describes a certain kind of person, a person with an obtuse sense of entitlement, a refusal to acknowledge what's due other people, and it contains an evaluation that such people are reprehensible. Now, the fact that it's a vulgar word adds something to that. It adds a note of anger and intensity that it wouldn't have if it weren't that sort of word. After all, there's nothing in the nature of the meaning of the word that you couldn't say about Donald Trump on the op-ed page of the New York Times if only you picked another less vulgar term.
With respect to the N-word, if you go back and, say, read Huckleberry Finn, there he's, I think, reporting fairly accurately the usage of the N-word when he was growing up. Both Jim and Huck use it, as do the more, you know, educated and adult people in the community. So what was its status then? Was it a mere descriptive term? Was it a descriptive term that happened to be for a class of people that were thought to be in some way inferior? I mean, what I would have thought, looking at the N-word, that it was pretty clear that its meaning came first, and only much later, when I would think consciousness raised, did it become taboo? Did people realize that there was something wrong with this?
Well, certainly that was in the 19th century. It was for many people just a descriptive word. Even in the 1920s, when H.W. Fowler published Modern English Uses, the first edition, this is not in later editions, he says of the N-word, this word, when used of someone not of African descent, is an insult, implying that it's perfectly okay to use it for somebody who is of African descent. So that's the usage, although even in the 19th century, there's a sense that it's kind of a vulgar word, that it's not the kind of word that genteel people would use.
Let's talk about vulgarity, because in reading your book, your fascinating book, Ascent of the A Word, one of the things that struck me is you report the history, how these vulgar words get into the common language. And vulgarity, marking them as vulgar is often marking them as, you know, of the lower classes. This is how the way soldiers speak or longshoremen or, you know, well, whatever, laborers speak. It's not the way the upper crust speaks. And so is the vulgarity just maybe it's not a specific linguistic thing. It's like a social class thing. That's their word, not our word. Right? I mean, how about that?
Vulgar itself, the word vulgar itself comes from the word for the common people, the vulgar tongue and so on. So swearing is always more about class than anything else. In the 19th century, people took their swear words from religious terms, damn and hell and so on, not so much because of religious reasons, but because it was an affront to the piety of these uptight Victorians. And when those feelings begin to dissipate around the turn of the 20th century, they go to these other words, the obscene words for body parts, and they start using those for their swear words.
So what I'm wondering then, okay, so I ask you whether my hunch that had something to do with the nature of their meaning was right or not. It sounds like you're saying, you know, well, it's more about kind of the ever-ongoing conflict of class and who gets to dominate our language. We won't let the language of those people dominate our language. Is that, I mean...
Well, I don't know if it's so much we won't let the language dominate our language, is that we all get to be a working class when we use this language. It's a mark of authenticity, of genuineness to use this language. That's something that happens particularly around 1970 when this language becomes really part of ordinary American speech. That's when you start to see the A word in Neil Simon plays and Woody Allen movies and so on. And it's a way of saying, I'm real, I'm authentic, and this guy, this A-word, has gotten above himself or is giving himself airs.
So your quote from Fowler fascinates me because, like most academics, I love that book, although later editions. And the remark does seem to betray a certain insensitivity to racism. But the phenomenon, a word is used non-derogatorily, is the way he's looking at it, when it's used for someone who actually fits it and derogatorily. That's probably a phenomenon that happens a lot. I mean, some people use the word philosopher that way. If they called Ken or I a philosopher, they wouldn't be saying something derogatory. But you, an empirical linguistic scientist, if one of your colleagues said, "Jeff, you're just being a philosopher."
Worst thing you could say about somebody, really.
Yeah, and if I were to call my beloved wife a Republican, she might be quite upset. I'd say, "Come on, you're verging on Republicanism there." But if I call my son a Republican, well, actually, since he's a libertarian, he'd probably be mad at me too. But if I call my father a Republican, if he were still alive, he wouldn't be insulted. So I wonder if there's an interesting phenomenon there where words start off with a kind of clear descriptive meaning, and then this Fowler phenomenon, you know, stripped of maybe its racist connotations, actually is an interesting thing that happens. Now, I don't think that's the right...
Sure, no.
That's not what happened with a-hole.
No, that is what happened with a-hole. But there are certainly cases of that. Fascist, for example, mm-hmm. We would say... Fascist is appropriately used of somebody who is a fascist, who's a member of the Nazi Party or the Falange or whatever, but that it's maybe misused when used of, and then you pick which of the both. It's an even-handed word these mm-hmm. days. Both sides use it for the other, but you could say it's misused, applied either to a right-wing Republican or a left-wing mm-hmm. a left-wing Democrat. So there certainly are words that have that have that quality. Faggot is an interesting word historically for that reason, because when I was a kid. It was just used for a wimpy kid. I think before I knew that it denoted homosexuals, it just was a wimpy kid. And that was the use that was offensive. And if it denoted homosexuals, that was a perfectly all right use of it. Mm-hmm. And it, at that time, before people realized there might be an issue here.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the linguistics of name calling in front of a live audience at the Mars Theater in Berkeley. And we've got questions from that audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Good morning. My name is Reza. I'm from San Francisco. And I'm of the Lenny Bruce school of linguistics, which is, or alternatively called the sticks and stones, which is, I give the word the power. So the story about the young ladies that turned ice cream back over on the people who were using it. Now, I understand that not everybody can interpret it in that way. So certainly the people who utter the N-word should be regarded with contempt, but from the recipient's perspective, they have the power to turn the word back around and diminish its power and its negative connotations, as indeed the African-American community has done by co-opting it and using it themselves. So I'd like you to address that.
That's a really interesting mm-hmm. thing. That's called the appropriated use of a racial slur. But I want to ask you to tie that to the A word. Could there be? It seems like you could do that with the N word. But it doesn't seem to me right that you could do it with the A word, right? Why is that asymmetrical?
Right. Well, there are people, I should say, who there's a small movement to reclaim the A word as if it were an epithet and say I'm an a-hole and proud of it. There's a guy, I won't even say his name, who goes around writing books about this sort of thing and recounting his adventures with women and booze and so on and so forth. Or there are people who model their life on Steve Jobs or somebody like that who do this. To my mind, I don't know if I'm just going to say this and we'll see if they bleep it or not. To be an a-hole is really to be obtuse about what you are. And if you think you're proudly declaring yourself an a-hole, you're not an a-hole at all. You're a dick.
Well, with that in mind, I want to give you some evidence. I don't know whether it's in favor of or against your hypothesis, but in Copperopolis, California, that's a real town. It was the world's biggest supplier of copper to the Union Army, by the way, in the world. Since then, it's fallen on hard times and mostly burned down. But there is a bar in Copperopolis. It's the second oldest bar, continuously operating bar. I don't know what they did during Prohibition in California or something like that. And if you're a regular at that bar, you can join the club,
which is called the A-holes, and you can get a T-shirt that says, I'm an A-hole and proud of it. Old Pro Bar, Copperopolis, California. So on your view, those guys are dicks. I'll have to take you to the bar someday and see.
We'll have the conversation.
See how that goes.
Guys, over. Can I bring some friends?
but yeah, there's a big difference between trying to reclaim the N-word. That's an act. That's a political act, an essentially political social act by the group who have been denigrated this way. And there isn't really a kind of coherent cohort that forms a social group of the a-holes, is there?
Nope.
So that's why it's different. It seems reclaiming the a-hole is like one person at a time, maybe, but reclaiming the N-word, reappropriating the N-word is like a collectivity.
Right, exactly. And those are groups in particular that have a sense of themselves as social groups toward whom various invidious attitudes are directed. And that's not the case of the A-word or the P-word or the S-word or all the other.
Although I suppose
this
could
family.
Become so if this club takes hold. But let's take some more questions from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Joel from San Francisco. We're talking in part about the prevalence of rude language. Actually, and we're enjoying speaking some rude language. I think rude language is fine. But I think we could also consider it prevalence of crude language. And crude language is unspecific, and it's unnuanced, and it takes a situation that has some specificity and refinement to it and just kind of throws some crude characterization at it. I wonder if you'd comment on that phenomenon.
Jeff, I think there's a bunch of examples in your book, and you were giving some earlier, thanks for the question, sir, that kind of go against that. Because you made me believe a-ho actually has a really specific meaning. There's really specific forms of bad behavior, bad being, that a-ho responds to, and it's different from, like, the S-word and the F-words, you know.
I think these words certainly do have specific descriptive meanings, as philosophers would say, that they denote a particular kind of person, and that we have, as I said, clear judgments as to whether somebody, although we may disagree on cases, as to whether somebody is deserving of the A word or the P word or some other word. But the crudeness, the point about crudeness is important, too. These words are crude. They have to be crude, because if they weren't crude, you would have nothing to indicate the full height of your indignation when your neighbor starts his leaf blower at 7 o'clock on Sunday morning. The point of having a crude word, a rude word, it's a word that enables you to say, your behavior is so contemptible that I no longer feel the obligation to obey the inhibitions that normally govern my conversation, or that my feelings have gotten the better of my
I wonder if there's what degree of specificity. So my neighbor blows, you know, is making this noise. Mm-hmm. Is there grounds for debating whether he's being an a-ho or an s-head or a f-wad? I mean, you know, is there room for debating these things, or just will any of them do? I mean, if it's not very specific, then any will do in any circumstance. But it seems there's some degree of specificity.
You know, if you look at dictionaries, they could give you the impression these words are all interchangeable. But dictionaries do an interestingly bad job on these words. They, too, tend to think of them just as the explosions of emotional steam. Still, when I was preparing the book, I actually gave a questionnaire, not systematically, to a lot of people. And I gave them some situations, and I said, what word would you use? One case I used, for example, involved a guy I know. He's a Texan. Found himself in New York on 9/11, desperate to get back home to Texas. The trains aren't even running. The planes aren't going. He goes over to the Hertz place on the west side. Vast crowd of people trying to rent cars. The beleaguered clerks trying to deal with it. And this little guy kind of pushes his way to the front of the line and says, excuse me, where's the gold card line? Now, it struck me that every person in that room had the same three-word thought, right?
Why don't we take another question before the break? Welcome to Philosophy Talk there.
Hi, I'm Susie from Berkeley. While you have reasons for not saying certain words on the radio because of governmental reasons, I wonder if by saying N-word and I don't know what P-word was, you give
rhymes
words...
with Rick.
Oh, okay. That one, I think you can say that one on the radio, but that's your call, not mine. Anyway, I wonder if you give words more power by not just saying the darn word. I really appreciate that the Guardian newspaper in Manchester, England, prints real words for real adults so we can know what people are saying. So I'd like to know your thoughts on that, please.
We had a lot of discussions about that, and my view was just what you said. In a way, that
an absence is more than a presence. The very fact that we don't say the word calls more attention to them than if we did.
But what do you think? There's a widely held view that, you know, we're just uptight about these words. If we could dispel these bourgeois hang-ups, we'd be able to use this language and it wouldn't have that effect. But I think that it's important to have restrictions on the use of these words. Now, how do you learn what a swear word means? You have to be told you shouldn't use it, and then you have to hear somebody using it. But ideally, the same person who told you shouldn't use it. And these restrictions, as absurd and silly as they seem, just stick in an asterisk and it's okay, nonetheless have the effect of continuing the power of the words. Because if they become just anodyne, ordinary words, again, we won't have anything to yell at somebody who cuts us off on the highway. We really need something that expresses that indignation.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. This time we're talking about the linguistics of name-calling with author and NPR commentator Jeff Nunberg.
In our final segment, we're going to talk about derogatory speech and the coarsening of public discourse.
We're coming to you from the Mars Theater, the Bay Area's breeding ground for new performance. We'll take more questions when Philosophy Talk continues.
Sticks and stones and broken bones, the way it was before.
Thanks to our live musical guest, the Playtones. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and our guest is Jeff Nunberg, author of Ascent of the A-Word. And let's take more questions from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, man.
Hi, I'm Zoe from Santa Monica. And I was really interested in your substitution of a-holes for dicks. and I think maybe one of the reasons for the ascendance of a-hole is because outside of the donkey context, everybody has one. I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Yeah, it's an interesting point.
Viva la difference.
The fact is that although other languages have words that do pretty much what a-hole does, there are also little small parts of the pendejo in Mexican Spanish, which is pubic hair, and stronzo in Italian, which is turd. The fact is that a-hole, unlike dick, is not a gender-specific part of the body. And for that reason, its restriction to males, which is largely the case, is interesting. And I think there's several reasons for that. I think one reason that people tend to use the word for males is that, you know, it's often about people in power, and more males are in positions of power, and it's about people who are apt to go around saying, "Do you know who I am?" You know, invariably don't themselves, and they tend to be men. And the third reason is that I think when a woman does something that would get a man called an a-hole, we tend to use the b-word. We call her a bitch, as if all of a sudden it's not about some swollen sense of entitlement, but some primordial female malignity. Right. And I think gender equity, and I mean this dead seriously, gender equity requires that we use a-hole indiscriminately of men and women when they behave in this
way.
But
now, you know, you said something interesting about we tend to call people with an overblown sense of self-importance and all that sort of stuff the A-word. But, you know, that actually makes it sound like a kind of defensive slur. So here's somebody who's puffing themselves up, and a way to bring them down is to call them this word that demeans them. And it can be deserved because, you know, it's a way of bringing them down. Because I think of another slur in kind of this way, hunky. People say hunky is just as bad as the N-word. I say, well, no, it's not, because hunky, when it was in currency, was a defensive slur. It was a slur by the powerless, the relatively powerless, of the relatively more powerful. And that's why slurs aren't always verboten, because sometimes a slur is an act of kind of self-affirmation. Well, what do you think?
No, I think it's a good point. I think that the difference between the A word, which in certain contexts does the work that old words like cad and bounder did in another age, or even heel.
Those sound so quaint now.
Well, they are quaint, but because they reflected the view from on high. These were people who failed to be gentlemen like us,
yeah,
right?
Right?
Where when you call somebody an a-hole, you're saying this is somebody who's got above himself, unlike those of us, we proles, we popular, vulgar types. So the point of view has changed, but there is this looking up that's implicit in the A-word. Yeah.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Well, thank you. Brian from San Francisco. When I grew up, it seems like the slur words and the derogatory comments that were getting kicked around on the playground were a little less hurtful, maybe. I got called a carrot top when I was a kid because I have red hair. And, you know, it kind of defines me as, not like my skin tone, certainly, but my hair color. It seems like now the discourse is getting much more vulgar. I mean, when on cable news, you can see people are saying certain words. They don't, you know, they bleep them out, but you can obviously hear what they're saying. You've talked about the A word. You talked about the D word. It seems to me we haven't talked about the F word.
The F word and the S word, I think linguists feel, have lost all meaning, right? I mean, you can use them for practically anything, which, according to Jeff's thesis, is not at all true of a-hole.
Well, the interesting thing is that when these vulgar terms, these obscene terms, become the source of new vulgarities at the beginning of the 20th century, several things happen. First of all, they become the basis for new expletives, effing and so on, that really don't have, they're just emphatic markers. But they also create new descriptive terms, like a word, but also like compounds like effed up and effed over and eff off and so on. And those are really interesting because the language has never done anything like that before. Created a descriptive vocabulary for various kinds of social gaffes and miscreants and so on and so forth, based on obscene words, but not in themselves obscene, inheriting their obscenity, their vulgarity, through a kind of word magic from their literal meanings. And this is new. The language has never done this.
Good for language. Now, in our intro, Ken was kind of lamenting the coarsening of our public discourse. But Merle's song that Carolla sang had a somewhat different perspective. I mean, go back to Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton. People often say, isn't it amazing that our founding fathers, who we think we're so wonderful, and yet look at all the terrible things that Adams said about Jefferson and Jefferson said about Adams and so forth and so on. But if you go back to that time, you find Aaron Burr shooting Alexander Hamilton. So you might say the coarsening of public discourse in contrast to shooting one another seems like a really positive a positive step forward. The idea that you can have words so powerful that they can supplant guns, I think that's an amazing linguistic development.
Don't you agree?
Well, I think you're both wrong, right? I don't know. A little of both. The public discourse, it's true, it takes a certain misplaced nostalgia to think that things used to be at this golden age of comedy. People have always been pretty nasty to each other. But I think the tone has changed, and that while we're no more vituperative than we were, we're vituperative and nasty in new ways. And that's why I was so interested in the A word, not just because of the word, but because it signals a certain attitude, a certain kind of play almost that you see in public media, where all of a sudden political vituperation has become a 24/7 form of entertainment. So Westbrook Pegler, the acerbic columnist of the Roosevelt years, could say nasty things about Jews, things you would never allow anybody to say, even on Fox News. But he wouldn't have thought to say what Ann Coulter does about the 9/11 widows, that they enjoyed their husband's death. It just seems like it would seem like a bizarre thing to say for him because it was off the point.
Okay, so is there a link? I mean, there's a social phenomenon there, right? But is there really a linguistic phenomenon? I mean, you're a linguist. I mean, you're many things, but you're a linguist. Is there a phenomenon of interest to you qua linguist there?
Well, I think that as a linguist, what's interesting to me is that the appearance of a new word can signal the emergence of new set of attitudes and sometimes enable us to get at those attitudes in ways that we wouldn't be able to get at through any other lens. And that's what interests me about a word like the A word, or a word like cool, or a word, any number of words that appear in the language and signal social changes
so
that
you're
are
not,
hard to get hold
of. I mean, you're not defending what's called the superior wharf hypothesis, that sort of language precedes thought. I mean, some things aren't thinkable unless you have certain words. The words determine what you can be thinking. But it sounds like you're suggesting language kind of, let's call it, compiles thought into a salient, highly shareable thing. I mean, is that the kind of...
Yeah, it crystallizes thoughts, and it makes connections that we otherwise wouldn't be able to make. The idea that the guy who's a rotter to his girlfriend that the driver on the highway who cuts you off, that the boss who is imperious to the people, and so, that they all share, they're all members of the same category and share the same evaluation. So, that's something we would have trouble thinking if we didn't have a common word for that.
Right, but so the invasion, as it were, of these words of derogation out of the private sphere into the public sphere reshapes the public sphere in a way. It becomes a sphere of kind of mutual derogation. So Rush Limbaugh is saying to 20 million people a day, feminazi, and they're repeating feminazi, and you know.
I think that the one thing to bear in mind is that when people talk about the mounting tide of incivility, the coarsening of American public life, these are phrases that come with the system disc nowadays. When people use those phrases, they imply that there's a sort of a moral decline in this. And I think the important thing to realize is that it answers the rise of these phrases and this language, answer to the same principle that makes us indignantly and self-righteously use the A word to the guy who cuts us off on the highway. That is to say, it's a rise of a certain kind of untempered moral indignation that allows this to happen. And it's a much more complicated and nuanced phenomenon than the op-ed tirades on incivility would lead.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, I'm Anna Marie from San Francisco. I think there's a time and place issue. For instance, with the A word, if Ken and his wife were at a philosophy department party and he was acting as an like an a-hole to his students and fellow faculty members, it would be very inappropriate for his wife to yell a-hole across the room. she would more appropriately wait until they were in the car on the way home.
Yeah, we always criticize her when she does that.
But I think there are other places where that is too, where it's appropriate to whisper something to your neighbor, but certainly not say it out loud.
I think you're right. Thanks for the observation. What do you think?
Yeah, no, that's clearly right. And what's interesting about this language is that, as I say, these words, a word like the a-hole doesn't. There's nothing in the meaning of the word. If I say Donald Trump is an a-hole, I'm not saying anything about him. I couldn't say
2 + 2 = 4
on television if I just use another word. But the use of that word restricts its use to this kind of intimate context among friends. It gives it that quality, which it doesn't it essentially have.
But what if Donald Trump was, or whoever, was openly being an a-hole in some large public event, and all the consumers of that public event were thinking, what an a-hole Trump is being, but the person to whom he's being an a-hole in this public couldn't call him out on that, using that word. Well, what's up with that? Why can't we, are we all allowed to think, God, he's being such an a-hole, but the recipient of his a-holeness in this large public event isn't allowed to say, you're being an a-hole, Donald, stop it.
I think there's a reason why we coined these new words on the basis of obscene and vulgar terms. It just didn't happen. And one of the reasons is that they give us a kind of private language. And remember, these words are coined originally by GIs to describe officious and vainglorious officers. Mm-hmm. And they create a sense of solidarity in the shared vulgarity. And that's the trade-off we make. To create that sense of solidarity, we have to forego the opportunity of using them at yelling them across a philosophy.
So this is kind of an anti-private language. There is a private language, and obscenity is the language of of privacy.
Yeah, but you don't need an obscene word to coin one of these words. I mean, suppose I were to say, oh, that guy is being a real a-hole, but, you know, he's not being a total Trump. Yeah. Everyone would immediately grasp what I'm saying.
Look, the word I find strongest, the other day somebody trying to get ahead of me in the line at Whole Foods, and I'm about to use the A word, and I say, no, hey, I say, there's a line here, Sparky. Right? And I find Sparky cuts more deeply than any vulgar word I can use.
That's brilliant. I'm going to have to try that one, Jeff. That's really brilliant. You know, it's been really great. This has been a wonderful, fascinating conversation. And this book, Ascent of the A-Word, it's a really cool book. I love the book.
Thanks so much.
Our guest has been Jeff Nunberg. He's a professor of linguistics at the UC Berkeley School of Information. He's author, most recently, of Ascent of the A-Word, A-holism, the First 60 Years. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
So, John, you non-a-hole, you buddy of mine. So, what are you thinking now?
Oh, it's always fun to have Jeff on. I think of our show in terms of Jeff cycles, right? He writes a book every couple of years. We have him on. And one of the great things about Jeff, not just in his books, but in his columns that you read in the papers, in his NPR segments, he has this sense of finding empirical methods, not necessarily experimental methods, but empirical methods, whether looking on Google or just asking people or looking through old columns that give you a whole new way of thinking about things that in the old days you would just, you know, you'd look up Fowler or some maven, you know, some self-appointed expert on words. Jeff brings a whole new dimension to the study of all that.
It's an extremely rich area, extremely worth thinking about, and we'll keep thinking about it because this conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. You can also find out more by visiting our very active Facebook page. You can follow our tweets on Twitter, and you can get the free weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk at our website, philosophytalk.org.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2012.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Music from Carola Kreitmeier and Joshua Raul Brody, the Playtones.
Special thanks to Eric Blazeski and Stephanie Weissman. Thanks also to Dan Brandon, Caitlin Esch, Dave Millar, James Hanley, Amy Kessler, and Merle Kessler.
The program is produced by the one and only Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and from the members of KALW Local Public Radio, San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of any of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
You're listening to WHFR Dearborn.